become a member of the Movie Geeks United family. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/MovieGeeksUnite, Facebook at facebook.com/MovieGeeksUnited, YouTube at youtube.com/MovieGeeksUnited, or bookmark our website at MovieGeeksUnited.net. And you can also access our entire library of programs, including more than 600 filmmaker interviews, right here on Blog Talk Radio at blogtalkradio.com/MovieGeeksUnited. Tuning in to Movie Geeks United. Got an exciting one tonight. Actress Sasha Gray will be here to talk about her new film, Would You Rather? And writer-director Justin Eugene Evans will talk about his new espionage thriller, A Lonely Place for Dying. But first, let's get to some movie news. Hey, guys.
Hey, man. What's up?
Hey.
So the big news from this weekend, Die Hard 5. It's 5, right? Yeah, Die Hard 5 came out, and it hit the top spot, but just narrowly beating Identity Thief and Safe Haven.
2013, you've had 4 big action films open. The Last Stand, The Bullet to the Head, Parker, and now Good Day to Die Hard. Now, Good Day to Die Hard has actually done well.
Well, I think ultimately Die Hard 5 is not doing well. I mean, because it opened up at $25 million, and I think it's going to fall quick because it's not a good movie.
No, it's not. It has the same problem Taken 2 has, maybe even worse. It just feels like, it doesn't even feel like it's John McClane. It just feels like it's Bruce Willis in those wine cooler ads that he used to do during Moonlighting or whatever. It doesn't even feel like a Die Hard film. It feels rushed. It feels like an afterthought.
I mean, it does feel like completely half-hearted, and they've lost track of what made John McClane kind of the working-class reluctant hero. I mean, that was the appeal of John McClane. And as amazing as some of those situations are in the first, well, at least for me, the first and the third movies, which are my two favorites of the series.
I think the third one may be my favorite, actually.
But it was never completely unbelievable, and he got the hell beaten out of him. I mean, he was shredded by the end of part three, you know. This one is so completely cartoony and CGI'd up. To the point, I mean, the CGI in this thing, especially at the climax, is ridiculous. And I was like, am I really seeing that they're doing this to a Die Hard? And Willis, it seems like, could not care less about the legacy that he helped create. And let's be honest, Die Hard, when it came out in 88, no one expected anything from it. It starred a TV actor.
Right.
You know, and it was this, you know, an action movie in an office building. But what Die Hard did was it kind of re-energized the action genre. And a lot of people took that John McClane Die Hard blueprint and tried to run with it.
Yeah.
You know, people were getting tired of the steroid-injected Stallone and Schwarzenegger. And he was like a kind of a real-world action hero.
I think there's three more. I think
couldn't be further from this.
Give me your weapons. Do you know what I hate about the Americans? Everything. Especially cowboys. What's
funny there?
It's not you. I love these outfits.
You remember the last time we talked before you went away?
Ah, no. No. You're not going to open up to me right before we die.
So that's not your thing, John.
What's my thing?
Killing bad guys. That's your thing.
You're not going to die today.
The thing, once we get to Chernobyl, I mean, all suspension and disbelief is just thrown out the window. Reality is thrown out the window. And that's a good point to bring up. He got beaten up. He was, you know, he was human. He was mortal. He was not like Schwarzenegger or Stallone. He was a down-to-earth. He was, as David Hansen said about Die Hard 2, he was a blue-collar James Bond.
Right,
And there's actually that line that he says about his son, which I thought would have been more apt for him. You're the 007 of Plainfield, New Jersey, or whatever. In the trailer, you think, oh, he's talking about himself. But no, he's actually talking about his son. And that felt tacked on, the whole relationship.
Completely. That whole heart-to-heart that they have, like three-quarters of the way through it, by the trunk of the car.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's
like,
awful.
You know, it's too late for that, man.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't save this with sentimentality now. I mean, the whole thing is so fake and false.
Mm-hmm.
It's just ridiculous, and the villain isn't in any way memorable. The action, there's so much kind of close-up blurriness in a lot of the action scenes. I mean, a couple of the stunts are fine, especially in that car chase, but I didn't like the way it was shot. It looked like a second-rate director, John Moore, who did what, From Paris with Love, and what else did he do?
Then John Moore, he does the remakes, the Omen and Flight of the Phoenix remakes, and is that him?
I thought he did that John Travolta movie, From Paris with Love.
Oh, I think From Paris with Love, that's one of the Luc Besson's guys? That's a French.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I think this is the remake guy, Flight of the Phoenix and the Omen, I think.
Well, you know,
yeah.
After that fourth Die Hard, that should have been an Omen, not to make another one.
Yeah, I mean, that one at least had a decent premise, you know. With
Behind Enemy Lines, John Moore did. Behind Enemy
Lines.
Well,
yes, there you go. Let's make Owen Wilson an action star. That turned out really well. But, you know, my thing is this. You know, you have this, you have Taken 2. Did Stallone, Schwarzenegger, now even Willis? And it's a shame about Willis is because he is, I think, better than those guys. He does something like Looper or Moonrise, especially Moonrise Kingdom. And in over the years, he's proven like 12 Monkeys or Pulp Fiction or Nobody's Fool. He's a really great actor.
And plus, I like him in Red. And I'm really looking forward to Red 2.
Oh, God,
so,
I wish Red 2 was showing instead of this. I was really hoping. Is Helen Mirren going to show up? And no, of course she doesn't. But, you know, do these guys not understand? I think this maybe even goes for Jason Statham as well, who I like a lot, actually, and I don't think Parker's a bad movie, but it's not really a great movie either. It's just sort of there. Do these guys not understand in the Expendables movies that the reason it works is because they're making fun of themselves?
Mm-hmm.
Are they not aware that that's really the charm of those movies, and then they go...
Well, I mean, is there ever a sense in the new Die Hard movie that they're making fun of Die Hard or anything? I mean, is there any...
I think you're giving them too much credit.
Well,
okay.
whatever attempts at humor are in the film, and it has the typical one-liners and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's completely dead. I mean, completely flat. No laughs land.
You're bored.
The one-liners don't even make any sense. You know, how many times can he say, I'm on vacation?
Oh, I know. And, oh, my God.
I mean, they're so tired. It really, really is. I mean, I wish that McTiernan had already served his prison sentence, so he could have been the one directing this one. I predict that he knows how bad this movie is, Bruce Willis. I predict he'll do a sixth one, and maybe he'll wait until McTiernan gets out of prison and try to convince McTiernan to come back with it.
And maybe he'll have one of those bracelets on that tracks where you are, and John McTiernan will on the set, and he can come out of prison to make it.
Because McTiernan is a real special – he's actually a very special director.
Yeah, no, I agree.
I think so.
And even with the last one, look, the last one is only good because it's been such a long time since the last Die Hard. You're happy to see McClane, but, you know, let's be honest. And you think about Die Hard, you think about the first three. You're not going to think about the fourth one even. And even though the fourth one does, you know, he's an interesting villain. the guy from Justified, who I like a lot, Timothy Oliphant. I mean, it's an interesting premise. Don't get me wrong. I think actually the premise is interesting. You actually feel there is a sense of danger. Here you feel no danger, none whatsoever. There's not.
Well, if anyone that thought that the fourth one was bad, and a lot of people do, watch this one, and you'll start to like the fourth one a lot
more.
Oh,
you'll think it's the best movie in ever made.
And actually, in terms of villains, you can't beat Alan Rickman. But McTiernan was smart enough when he came back for the third one to cast Jeremy Irons. So that was delicious as well to have
right.
Jeremy Irons in there. With the failings of, I guess the Expendables 2 did well. They still have big international audiences too.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure the Bruce Willis does as well, and the Die Hard name.
Oh yeah.
But and international counts for a lot more than U.S. in a lot of cases. But with their failings here in the U.S. with Bullet in the Head and The Last Stand,
mm-hmm.
And now Die Hard being a bad movie, I mean, has nostalgia worn out its welcome?
I think with these guys, maybe it has. I was thinking about this on the way home from Die Hard. It's really interesting. The action franchise that was inspired by all these guys that started out, I thought, really bad, but has gotten better recently is the Fast and Furious. Is that the genre's, like, savior? Because that is something that I thought the first couple were horrible. I'm not a big fan of those. But then when you get to the fourth, and especially the fifth one, when you get The Rock in there, it's really actually quite entertaining.
That franchise seems to have been re-energized.
Yeah, I think that's the franchise to watch. But I think these guys,
there's only so many I'm getting too old for this stuff jokes you can tell.
And they were doing that when these were popular. They were saying that line. You know, they had that.
Yeah.
I guess the case will be if they make another 48 hours, then we know we're in deep, deep trouble.
Well, and the heir apparent to those people, are The Rock and Jason Statham.
We've been spoiled by Paul Greengrass and by Christopher Nolan, and by the Bourne Legacy movie. We've been very spoiled. We've had these people taking it to new levels, and it seems like a letdown when you go to see something like The Last Stand or a Die Hard after you've had a Dark Knight Rises and a Bourne Legacy. Look, Taken 2 couldn't compete with that. I mean, Taken 2 was just a bad idea. I mean, just look, you know, it's not good when your movie is basically like a travel log, essentially.
Yeah, well, I don't want to visit any place where I'm going to get kidnapped.
I realize that. I mean,
that's like the worst travelogue I've ever seen.
Yes, it is.
Do you want to have your family kidnapped and tortured?
Mine, that
visit
would be
our
fine.
Country.
I have no problem with that.
I saw Room 237.
You saw it?
Yeah.
How is it?
I have to watch it again, I think, because I didn't quite like it. The whole thing is... it presents various theories about the meaning of The Shining, which we've done on the show before, and we have these filmmakers on the show for our Shining program.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just their voices. They sent out recording devices to each of the five participants, and they said, well, just watch the movie and record your observations into this machine, and we'll use your voices as narration as we run through clips of The Shining and various other movies and media and make a kind of collage, a lot of it kind of a subliminal collage of images to express what you're saying. There are moments in those images where they really get you really get a feeling of what they're going for, of this deepening mystery behind the secret meanings of The Shining. But there are other times when it's just terribly convoluted. And the pieces of narration they choose to use are not very clear. See, and I guess I'm coming at it from a place where, you know, I've talked to a lot of these people, so I know their views. So when I look at this movie, I'm looking to have those views expressed as I understand them. And it's not always clear to me. They don't come through a lot of times. You know, you're like, what? That doesn't make any sense. But actually, when you read their stuff and when I heard from them, it did make sense, their observations. But
right.
it's not explained well enough in the movie or illustrated well enough in the movie. And they make a mistake, too, in that, you know, I think the most relevant theory behind The Shining comes from Jeffrey Cox. A lot of people disagree, but Jeffrey Cox, who says that the movie is a metaphor for the Holocaust, and he has a lot to back that up. Jeffrey Cox is one of the talking heads in Room 237.
Mm-hmm.
One of his major findings has to do with numerology, the number 42. So he brings up 42 on Danny's shirt, 42 as a multiple of room 237, 42 just right down to the 7-Up in the hallway, 6 crates of 7-Up equals 42. And it keeps repeating throughout The Shining. And 1942 was the year of the final solution, where they decided
right.
what to do with the Jews, to terminate the Jews. So that's kind of haunting. That's included in the movie, but it's broken up so that he only makes one observation about the number 42. And then the movie goes into all kinds of different stuff for an hour, like a whirlwind of stuff, and then it comes back to the 42. So you have to kind of reacclimate yourself to that argument that 42 represents something. It's not as linear. It doesn't have the clarity that I wish it would have, and I really wanted to love it. I really wanted to show it to friends who are unconvinced that there's something more to The Shining and say, let me show you something that'll blow your mind. But this movie was not it for me,
okay.
unfortunately.
That's very sad to hear, because I remember that. I remember when we did that interview, and it was a great interview. That's
how it's one of our top interviews on YouTube as well.
Mm-hmm. No, it is. Yeah, no, and I was reading the comments of that this weekend. No, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
It's
there are people fighting back and forth on YouTube, and I'm like, keep it up, guys. Because
keep it up. Help us out.
The more you click on that, yeah, it's great.
It's funny, because I have been going to, you know, I've had to explain to my two brothers that, you know, my mom, that we have basically, or not we, you, Jamie, have created the, like, basically, I think, the most complete, up-to-date database for everything Stanley Kubrick. And they look at me like I'm nuts. But I'm just like, no, but I have to explain this. Please, Jamie, what we've done here is we really created, like, everything you need to know about Stanley Kubrick, we've done. And I really believe that. I was just, like, there's a David Ignatius op-ed in the Washington Post today about what's going on in Egypt and in the Middle East since the Arab Spring, and he's comparing it to A Clockwork Orange, the book and the film.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like thinking, hey, you know, Dave, you know, come listen to our show. You know? I know you do all this foreign
yeah.
stuff, but... You know, a lot of the stuff that he says about A Clockwork Orange was covered in our Clockwork Orange thing.
And this movie is going to really go out there. I mean, it has gone out there. And a lot of people are going to see it. A lot of people are going to be exposed to the different theories for the first time. You know, and I have people that don't know that we did this back in December 2010, and they say, hey, did you know about this? And I said, yeah. And you would have too if you would have been listening.
Yeah.
2 years ago.
Yeah,
you know?
God damn you.
yeah.
But let me ask you this, Jamie. Because I haven't seen the film yet. What did you want from the film? What did you want?
Well, what I was most excited about is actually in the film.
Okay.
And that's my day, but the closing credits. So, you know.
Amen, brother.
I will have to watch it again.
Okay.
Because maybe I didn't get everything that was in there. But they also, I mean, and there were three moments in the movie, actually, to the movie's credit, three moments where it exposed something that I absolutely didn't realize about the film. Through these different observations, there, John Fell Ryan, who I got to say, John Fell Ryan was part of this movie, of our podcast series as well. He's the the shining forwards and backwards guy. He was going through the different fades because Kubrick fades in or dissolves between shots a lot. There's one dissolve going from, oh, I can't remember who, to a picture or something of Jack. And it looks like for a brief frame, the mustache of the person it's dissolving from and into Jack, it gives Jack a Hitler mustache for a frame, that particular dissolve. And I said, oh, my God, I didn't realize that. And there are a couple others that were like, oh, my gosh, that opens up a whole new avenue. Jay Widener's in it, the UFO, the NASA guy.
Right, okay.
The Kubrick fake the moon landing guy. And for some reason, I mean, Jay Widener has a fan club. I mean, people either love or hate him. But I've heard a lot of support for him as well. But the funniest thing that happened when I talked to him, he was going through, you know, Kubrick faked the moon landing, and this is what proves it, and The Shining, and this whole, like, proposition, like, this big, massive conspiracy Kubrick was involved in. And then he goes through the sexual perversity of the movie and, you know, penises and the scotch glasses and all this kind of stuff. And then he starts to talk about Jeffrey Cox's theory about the Holocaust and the numbers. And I remember I was talking to him and he said, yeah, I know that Jeffrey Cox has this theory about numbers and the number 42 and that stuff, but that's just crazy. And I'm like, yeah, that's crazy. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so there is. That's interesting too. You know what would be? You know what would be more interesting than what Room 237 did? Would actually be to get all of these participants together in a room. You know?
Yeah.
And have them work out.
Fight it out.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be interesting.
Is there ever any sense in the film that they have any kind of sense that reading this much into a movie is kind of nutty?
Well, you know, I think that anyone that thinks about it, when you live inside that movie as much as they do, you kind of don't see the forest through the trees after a time, you know? But there's also this, and I think that like people like Bill Blakemore are very clear about this. He says, listen, this is why I see this in this movie. I live near a Navajo reservation, and I came from this kind of culture, and I'm an ABC News reporter. I've reported on conflicts throughout the world. So I'm in that mind frame when I go see The Shining for the first time. So that made me susceptible to discovering these things. And it really does show, and this is the value of Room 237 and the value of exploring these theories related to The Shining, that no one else seems to get. It really shines a light on the way you see a movie and how that is entirely informed by who you are, by your consciousness, and why that movie can be a different experience for you than it is for someone else.
Yeah.
I get that. I mean, I mean, I think we all do. Everyone on the show gets that.
But for some reason, for some people to think that by exploring these theories, you're besmirching the true intention of this movie and the appreciation of this movie. I'm sick of, you know, if you feel like this somehow lessens your appreciation of The Shining, then you never had an appreciation for it to begin with. Is my point of view.
I'm hosting a dinner party tomorrow night, and I'd like you to join us. I mean, there'll be other guests there, people who just haven't received a fair shake in life. And the evening will culminate with a game.
A contest.
Each player will be given a choice between A or B.
What the hell is this?
Decision-making in its rawest form. Would you rather electrocute yourself?
Oh, no, I see where this is going.
Or?
I don't think I can do this either.
15 seconds. Go.
No. No, I can't do this.
You must make the decision. Game.
What the fuck is the matter with you people?
Would you rather?
You sick fuck!
have her anywhere?
Okay, superstar Sasha Grey is with us tonight. She became a sensation in the adult film world, and now she's making quote-unquote legitimate films, starting with The Girlfriend Experience under the direction of Steven Soderbergh and moving on to a great reoccurring role in Entourage. Her new movie is called Would You Rather? It's a really dark and fun horror thriller. It's about a group of people that attend a mysterious dinner party, and they're set up to play the game Would You Rather, except the challenges incurred in this game become more and more ghoulish. It's available now on video on demand systems. It's also in limited release. It started February 8th in limited release. Our guest interviewer, Tony Farinella, spoke to Sasha, and here she is to tell us all about the film Would You Rather.
Your character in this film is very vicious, but it comes from a real wounded place. I was framed to play someone with no regard for others.
I think it was extreme. Yeah, I guess you could use that word. You know, at this point in Amy's life, she's trying to buy her freedom, essentially. So, you know, her husband killed her daughter, and she's not able to prove it, but she knows he did it. So she's sort of lost faith in humanity and in everything, and she already comes from, a damaged background. So this is her only way out.
And you mentioned some aspects of her backstory. For you personally, did you sort of fill in sort of other areas of her backstory on your own?
Yeah, I was able to work on that and bring it to David. And, in the script, it was clear that the daughter was killed. But, everything else in between, I was able to create and go over with the director, David Levy.
Mm-hmm. Was there any sort of part of her that you could relate to in your own life at all, or no?
Oh, wow. I think there's always things you have to try and relate to bring life to a character, but, I mean, this, you know, she was a young mother. I don't have any children, but I do have nieces. I just tried to imagine those things, the sense of loss and the sense of somebody abandoning you and losing faith in humanity. I think we've all had those moments, but for Amy, it's tenfold. Obviously thinking about the people I love in my life and how I would feel if something like this would happen to me.
And for you personally, even though you've done films before and television shows, how comfortable are you feeling right now as an actress in films?
I feel like I'm still learning and still building and still navigating my way. But it's exciting, and I really wouldn't have it any other way. On the set, I felt completely in my own skin and completely comfortable and strong and able to ask the questions that need to be asked without fear.
As far as the audition process as an actress, how are you feeling when you walk into a room to audition? Do you feel confident? Do you still feel unsure of yourself? How are you feeling when you go on different auditions for films?
I don't think I've ever met an actor who loves auditions. I think I've been on one audition two auditions where I was really able to get into a character and kind of explore a character with the casting director. And that was great because you didn't feel rushed, but I think most actors feel the same self-conscious feeling when you walk in a room with other people and that sense of feeling rushed to hurry up and get through something and the sense of wanting, and feeling like you have to puke, which thankfully I've never done. But I think it's something that all actors are plagued with. So now I try and... I had this one, it's funny, I have this audition, and when I got it, I was like, I really didn't understand why it was being sent to me. The character was 10 years older than me, and it wasn't the type of thing like where the age could be changed because the other actors were already cast.
Right.
So I really didn't understand it, and I was kind of, to be honest, I was a little pissed off, like, what? I don't understand. I don't understand why I'm being sent out for this, but I was like, you know what? I'll just take it as an experience, another, you know, to try and shed that insecurity of going into an audition room. And I got it, like, really late at night, the night before.
Mm.
But, you know, I just try to think of it as, like, a positive thing. Like, look, I'm actually being asked to go on audition. This is a great opportunity. Like, stop complaining. But it was really quick. And the day of, I was just like, you know what? I'm going to act like this doesn't matter at all, but still go prepared.
Right.
So I used my cold and my illness and my grumpiness to kind of fuel this character, and the casting directors loved it, and they were laughing the entire time, and I was like, whoa, that worked. And it was really bizarre. So now I try and approach auditions a little – sorry, my dog is barking. I try and approach auditions a little more relaxed and just go in knowing that, you know, they have to see 100 people and you know, not worry about it so much, because it's not, you know, it doesn't mean you're getting the role and you're not filming. It's just a chance to show yourself on tape.
Right. It's interesting, too, because, you know, you would think after having Steven Soderbergh have confidence in you that they would sort of, you know, help you in future roles. What is it about him, I guess, makes him so unique? And what are your feelings on his retirement?
What makes him so unique? Well, I think if you watch his films, that kind of answers all the questions. But I think he's able, you know, he's always been able to tread that line between making big films and also making really personal films. And even when he does a huge film, he's able to bring an authenticity, and he's able to have the audience ask difficult questions. I mean, even Magic Mike, it's like a popcorn movie, but you know, there's more to it than that. So
right.
I think that, you know, and he's also incredibly visual, obviously. In a world filled with CGI, he kind of simplifies things and brings you back down to earth, which I also really appreciate. And I hope he is not retiring, but we'll see.
And the thing I've been really impressed with you, Sasha, it seems like you're finding really unique, challenging, and outside-the-box films. Would you say that's sort of a conscious choice, or are these films finding you, would you say?
Well, I mean, obviously with the Soderbergh film, it came to me, and that was a great opportunity that I didn't want to turn down. And from there, that's when I decided to actually pursue acting. So I'd say now it's been more of a conscious decision to, since The Girlfriend Experience and since Entourage, to take on roles that are against type. And that's what I've been aiming to do, to prove that I can play, you know, a character that's not one-dimensional, and to prove to people that I am not just playing me. So, you know, I've been fortunate enough to have met some really incredible people along the way, and people who understand that.
All right. Thank you so much for your time. It was really good talking to you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
Okay, that was Sasha Gray. The movie is called Would You Rather? It's available now on video on demand and in limited release.
In the 1970s, before there was this guy, or this guy, or even this guy, there was
Paul Williams!
Okay, maybe you remember him and maybe you don't, but when I was a kid, I really wanted to be Paul Williams. He wrote Evergreen for her, and Rainy Days and Mondays for them, and The Rainbow Connection for this guy.
When you write a song with a girl's name, mm-hmm. You ever tell a girl, say, I was thinking of you when I wrote this? A
lot of Holiday Inns have heard those lines.
And he was in movies like this, and he won stuff like this, and I always thought he died too young, but last year I went online to buy one of his albums, and I found out something that amazed me. He's not dead.
Dean, we can talk about this. So I did, and maybe Jerry, if you've seen it, I did see Paul Williams is still alive.
Right. No, I did not see that. Okay.
That's on Showtime now. I just discovered it channel surfing today.
Okay.
I'll never forget today, ever.
Why are you wasting your time making a film about Paul Williams? Who cares?
I mean, I thought he would have liked the attention.
Come on, guys, that's enough. Get out.
This guy's a national treasure. He should be getting his own night on American Idol. Where's he been?
The winning Hall of Fame songwriter, Paul Williams.
Oh, my God, I can't watch it.
Look, all I know is that when he had everything, he was miserable. And now he's got a lot less and he seems pretty happy. How can that be?
I don't want to talk about that.
I gotta say, for a documentary, it's pretty good. We've got a love story.
Have your heart set on it.
Doesn't matter what I want.
If you do, I'll go into an In-N-Out.
There's friendship.
Are we out here to make the documentary about Paul, or are we out to, like, dish the dirt?
There's a little sex. There's a buddy.
We pull you in here, it just gets really authentic and gets my life. It becomes the Paulie and Steve show.
And there's a young hero, he starts with nothing, he gets everything, he loses it all, and then he finds redemption.
You know, I got into that film and really wanted to really love it because I'm a huge Paul Williams fan, always have been, you know, particularly speaking of his music, his songwriting. I wish I had some kind of collection of his I'm sure it's out there, but there must be some kind of collection of his performing his own songs or whatever. But I don't have it. But so I'm a fan, you know, and the filmmaker is a fan as well, obviously, and that's pretty obvious from like the very very beginning because he's narrating it. The filmmaker, and so from the very beginning, you know, I kind of find this whole trend that was sort of started with Michael Moore of filmmakers narrating their own movies and trying to make themselves into something of a celebrity or whatever, you know, rather than remaining invisible. It could be kind of irritating. And no one's more irritating from doing that than Nick Broomfield, who did the, Curt and Courtney and Eileen Wuornos and Biggie and Tupac documentaries.
Oh, he did that big time. I mean, he put himself, also he did Heidi Fleiss, right? Hollywood Madam, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, he's on camera, you know, all the time, just holding all the sound equipment and going up and knocking on doors without giving the interviewee any kind of preparation or whatever, just going to ask for an interview. Then he includes it in the movie. Why? Because they close the door on you or whatever? You just wanted to be in the movie. Anyway, with this filmmaker, whose name is not in front of me at the moment, but he narrates...
Stephen Kessler or Stephen Kessler or...
Yeah,
something
that's
like that.
Right. He narrates the film and, you know, explains his background and his you know, own kind of personal like of Paul Williams. And then we get into him, you know, starting to getting the idea of doing the documentary that we're watching. And it shows his sort of like, even though he's a, you know, nominally a professional or whatever, he gets paid doing commercials and things like that. He seems, you know, flummoxed by the whole idea of meeting one of his idols, and so you see him like making like really bad mistakes and so forth, and this changes over time, of course. But I don't know, that aspect of the movie, you know, just took me out of just the appreciation of Paul Williams just in general, you know, just telling his story, and now it becomes a story about a filmmaker who's trying to make a movie about Paul Williams, and that's not what I really wanted to see. So.
Yeah.
So I was kind of disappointed.
Well, there are moments in there that are kind of cringe-inducing and where you wish she made it less about him. But, you know, any documentary, whether the director appears on camera or not, it is in some form about the relationship between the director and the subject, because everything's filtered through the director's lens and the director's cues to the subject. But so in this case, I think it was, and this says something about Paul Williams too, Paul Williams actually asked him to get on camera, and that scene's in the movie. This would be easier for me if I'm actually playing off you on camera. And through the course of the movie, you find out that the only real way that Paul Williams is willing to open up is to have the director as a participant in the thing. And so that reveals itself as the movie goes on. And then you find out why, because Paul Williams is not a guy that necessarily likes to look back. He's very kind of forward thinking, and a lot of the stuff in his past is very painful to look back at. And so a lot of what this movie comes to as well is that when he finally does look back at some embarrassing moments when he appeared hosting talk shows when he was stoned or whatever, he discovers, you know, it's important that I actually own up to this and I show this in the movie because my recovery is very important to me, and I want to show this as an example of, you know, where I was and where I've come. There's also, I mean, I think it is fascinating, the idea of the director and how he gains access to the subject. And that's illuminated pretty well in this movie. What that journey is like to get into their comfort zone, you know, what bounds not to overstep. So it is about that. It's not, you know, I missed the first 10 minutes, but I didn't see anything about Phantom of the Paradise. There's barely anything about Bugsy Malone.
I know, all that stuff's crazy to me. There's so much that's left out about what he's really accomplished. And you know, they touch on a lot of stuff, but I don't know. Anybody coming to see doesn't know who Paul Williams is. It's not gonna. I don't know. Are they really gonna get it when it's all over?
I think they're going to get an idea of the core of who he is, and that's what I think special about the movie, because the director actually went in with the premise of probably doing a from birth to now kind of documentary about his life. It became something else, surprising to him. What the director wanted to know was, how could someone so brilliant and at the top of his game, the guy that wrote Evergreen and like an old-fashioned love song and Rainbow Connection and one of the great songwriters ever, how could he then be delegated to appearing on episodes of The Gong Show? That's the kind of documentary that he wanted to do. And Paul Williams said, look, I'm not the guy you want me to be. I'm not suffering because I'm not in the place now that I was in the 70s. I'm completely forward-thinking, and I am so much richer now than I was then. I have a wife. I have a family that I'm happy with. I have 20 years of sobriety. So it's about those two meeting, those two kind of concepts of what this documentary could be, you know, meeting in the middle in some way. I thought, at times it was kind of annoying how he put himself in the middle of it, but in the end I did see an end game to it and a value to it.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, you know, I didn't hate the movie. But it wasn't great like I was hoping it would be. That's all.
Did you guys see Inside Deep Throat years ago when that came out?
Yeah.
I rewatched that. I liked it a lot more this time than I did the first time I watched it. First of all, that thing really is in C-17. I mean, they really show graphic stuff in that movie. But that's an interesting movie, and I got a better visceral sense in that movie of the sexual revolution and what it meant, and how the political landscape of the time was threatened by it.
Right.
from this movie than I ever have with anything else I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a crazy story what this movie has gone through, Deep Throat, from, you know, government confiscation to being a political football with presidents and having the mafia own it and trying to make money off of it. And then Linda Lovelace, and then Harry Reams, the only actor that's ever been sent to prison for participating in a movie. Interesting movie. It really is.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have to check that out.
Did you watch Dear Zachary yet, Dean?
No, I can't. I haven't been able to find it, to tell you the truth. Actually, what I've been doing all weekend is watching movies on Hulu, because they have a whole... It's only for this weekend, you know, so I think it expires in a day or two, but they're offering up their entire Criterion collection to watch for free.
That's right, yeah.
Which is stuff that's, you know, usually just available on Hulu Plus, so... I'm trying to be very careful about what I watch because there's, you know, a lot of stuff. I mean, I'm watching it. I did watch one thing that I've already seen, which I love, which is Jean Dielman, the 1975 movie by Chantal Ackerman. And it's weird watching these movies. The Jean Dielman is like 3 hours long, and then it's got commercials, you know, peppered all the way through it, you know, every 6 minutes or so. So it kind of takes you out of the movie in a big way. Especially but still, it's an opportunity for me to see them because I don't have a lot of these movies, and I don't have any kind of video membership or anything like that. So not even in Netflix. So, I've been watching a little bit of Fassbender because, you know, people told me to watch it. I'm even more convinced now that I'm not a fan of Fassbender. because it's just not my deal, this sort of, like, over-the-top, you know, very, how can I say it, but just extremely sexual sort of... you know, world that he lives in with lots of you know, sick sex and weird stuff going on. I'm just like, ugh, gosh, I feel dirty. Let me go.
Half our audience is about to go look up Fassbender.
Yeah. the last thing I watched, I used to watch a lot of Fassbender. The last thing I watched by him a couple of years ago is probably one of his most famous films, Fox and His Friends.
Uh-huh.
I love that.
Fox and Friends, really?
Fox and his friends. Fox and his friends. Fox and his friends. So it's a great gangster film. Really good gangster movie.
Tonight, Godard will be directing the O'Reilly Factor.
Dude, that would Fox be awesome. Film. That would be awesome.
Yeah. Okay, Sorcerer. Hey, William Friedkin came through with news about Sorcerer. The whole legal debacle there about what studio owns what, I guess, has been settled.
Mm-hmm.
And so the original negative of Sorcerer is in good condition, and he's budgeting now for a new digital transfer to release on Blu-ray. But it won't be Criterion, but it will come out on Blu-ray soon, William Friedkin. He also has an autobiography that he's releasing April 9th, I think.
Oh, cool.
Ooh, that's
good. So we'll have him back on. So
that'll be great.
600-page autobiography. So, and he's a good storyteller.
No, yeah, he definitely. Yeah. Definitely is.
Yeah.
Peter Bogdanovich is directing a new movie after, I don't know, what was it? What was the last, Cat's Meow?
Cat's
Meow
was the last one, yeah.
Yeah, which was years ago. So it's a new comedy with Jennifer Aniston.
Oh.
Wow. That is... Oh. Wow! What? Wow! I mean, not a romantic comedy or just a?
I'm not sure if it's a romantic comedy.
If anybody should be making a romantic comedy, it should be Peter Bogdanovich. He's good at it. I mean, you know, if you've ever seen, you know, They All Laughed, or of course, you know, What's Up, Doc?
It's about
two of the greats.
It's about a Broadway director who falls for a prostitute turned actress.
Mm.
It's Jennifer Aniston, Sybil Shepherd, Eugene Levy.
That's quite a cast. Wow.
Wow.
Owen Wilson plays the director.
Okay. Wow. Oh. Okay.
Jason Schwartzman is in it too.
Oh. Well, this is a very smart. This is a very smart cast for him to direct. So definitely.
Yeah. I'm definitely looking forward to that. Hey, did you guys hear about the, I don't know if you guys are friends with Pete Gelderblom on Facebook.
Yeah, we
you
are.
Know,
no, he's been a great supporter of the show.
Yeah, he's so anyway, something interesting just happened to him. You know, he's in Holland, and for people who don't know, he's a filmmaker himself. Director of commercials and things like that, but also for short films, and is working, working on other projects. And he's also a cartoonist. He did Directorama, which is about the adventures of long-gone famous directors in heaven, you know. So
right, right.
Kubrick and Wells and John Huston, they're all up there. So anyway, he just got notified that he did a recut of Raising Kane.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And jumbled Raising Kane around, and apparently Brian De Palma has seen this recut of Raising Kane and was talking about it in Fangoria in a recent interview. So on a side note, you know, he's interviewing for Fangoria, so I assume that he's ready to be interviewed about Passion, by the way. But it says, Pete wrote a little quote out, from the article, and someone asked De Palma if he ever thought about remaking one of his films, and he says, well, as a matter of fact, somebody put Raising Kane together the way it was originally supposed to be done, and it gave me a lot of food for thought, because Raising Kane was originally supposed to start with the woman's story. You know, you follow her for the first 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And Lithgow's story doesn't start until you see him smother her. Mm-hmm. But when I was cutting the movie, I didn't think her story was interesting enough to sustain the long beginning, so I reversed it and put the Lithgow stuff first and used the opening scenes as kind of a flashback. And somebody got a hold of the original script and put it back the way it was supposed to be, and I thought it could really be interesting to actually do it the way I always wanted to. So he, was pretty floored by this. And
yeah, that's pretty great.
Quite interested in getting a hold of Mr. De Palma and talking to him about it, maybe.
What excites me is that. I mean, De Palma does look on the internet, and he knows everything that's out there about him.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's always a computer nut, so he's always been a big technological guy.
Well, we know that from when he found us.
Yeah.
But that Fangoria interview, it's apparently career-stretching. It's a long interview, and it's available now in their latest issue. And he's excited about the remake of Carrie. So he said that Kimberly Pierce had conversations about him,
mm-hmm.
To him about it, and said that he's excited about her approach to it.
All right, so we're a piece away from the Oscars, and the Lincoln backlash continues today.
Oh my gosh!
Maureen Dow is now saying that Spielberg should correct it, and I guess it's with this. I read her article earlier today. And, well, she said that Argo is also historically inaccurate, but she really goes after Lincoln, so it should be revised, especially for the DVD release, to reflect the proper vote, I guess, to make it accurate for, because if students are learning, they're going to learn the wrong history lesson. So Lincoln keeps getting just every week something new.
And this movie is being sent out to all middle and high schools.
Yeah.
A lot of middle and high schools, too. Right now, they're sending out DVDs of it.
Mm-hmm.
So they want to use it as an educational tool. I get in trouble any time I talk about Lincoln. I guess there was a thread that our friend Jason had on Facebook, and I cut in about this misrepresentation of the vote in the movie and Tony Kushner's excuse for it. And I just made it clear. I said, in my opinion, I don't know why they changed it from the real vote.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't add any drama or suspense to it. I mean, why not just have it be represented as it was in reality?
Right. Mm-hmm.
But their whole argument with changing the names of those who voted no was to protect the descendants, to protect the children that are still alive today,
mm-hmm.
so, to not kind of mar their family name. So if you're going to be protective of them, why are you besmirching an entire state that actually voted to abolish slavery by saying that they didn't vote for it?
Right, right.
I don't understand it.
Well,
but whenever I made the statement on that thread, and I was telling this to Dean, Sasha Stone comes out and essentially says that I'm racist. Like I said something racist.
I don't understand how you can be racist.
Well, you got to understand, she's just, you know, every year she picks one movie that she's going to go out for, and just, you know, she says that on her site that, you know, if you don't like this about her site, you can go someplace else. But she's going to go out for and live and die, you know, for this one movie that she picks, you know. So, you know, the year that, you know.
She's doing it for Lincoln?
Yes.
that's her pet movie. But to fall back on...
I love Sasha Stone. I didn't realize Lincoln was so that. I didn't realize...
You, you know, to fall back on, if you don't like this movie, there's something racist about you. It's fucking weak.
That is weak. But look, then on the same day, Ann Hornaday in the Washington Post, film critic for the Washington Post, main critic, basically says what we've been saying all along, that Django Unchained is the definitive movie about slavery. And even Frank Rich said that last week in New York Magazine, that Django Unchained, of all the Oscar-nominated movies, is the best film, the most accurate, if you will, reflection of America at that time, or even today, really. And I'll go, you know, one step further. I mean, Anne Hornaday even says that Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter is a better film. No, not the vampire part, obviously, but actually some of the historical references it makes is better than Lincoln. I don't know about that. I like Mary Elizabeth Winstead as Mary Todd Lincoln, but, you know.
I mean, the Spielberg's Lincoln is very accomplished in many ways.
It is a good movie. I'm not going to say it's not. I liked it. I mean, I enjoyed the movie.
But, you know, people...
Can I say this? Nobody would be saying anything about the historical accuracy of Lincoln if it wasn't Oscar season, because this is all stuff that's put out there to tear Lincoln's Oscar chances down. You know, nobody's talking about the historical. Nobody is really talking about the historical inaccuracies of Argo. But there
no, they are them. Actually. They are. People well, are talking about it. But they're not. Let's put it like this: Argo is the front runner. Argo
it's not taking.
It's not. No, it's not taking. But people are. There has been a lot of that, but it's not. I mean, I expect Argo to win Best Picture. I really do expect that to win Best Picture.
Well,
but look, Zero Dark Thirty has
been
crucified. As soon, even before it came out in wide release, Zero Dark Thirty is basically, you know, I don't even know.
And the reason for that was because they tried to do the same thing with A Beautiful Mind, and it didn't work with that.
Did that win Best Picture that year?
Huh?
Did that win Best Picture that year?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, look, I do think that there's something to Oscar campaigning and smear campaigns, and I do think that some of the dialogue going on about Lincoln has something to do with that. I don't necessarily think that's the case for Zero Dark Thirty, because I do think that Zero Dark Thirty could have been released any time, and its topic is such a political football
mm-hmm.
that it was bound to raise some controversy about torture.
Yes,
right.
That's true.
But Lincoln... I'm sure that it's in the dialogue now because of the Oscar campaigning and stuff. But if you're making a historical drama in the sense that they made it and they claim to have paid attention to every little detail, they did get it quite a bit wrong, particularly about who Lincoln is. And that's what always bothered me about Lincoln. I mean, that it doesn't have anything to do with Oscars or awards or anything like that. The fundamental flaw of Lincoln to me is how much it whitewashes Lincoln. And there's a great PBS series that just aired. It's like a 2-hour documentary about Lincoln, and you get a sense in Lincoln's own words in who Lincoln was and what his relationship was towards the different races.
Mm-hmm.
And none of that is in Lincoln because it doesn't fit the need to deify Lincoln. And when you watch Spielberg's Lincoln, you see that it's a complete whitewash after knowing
in a way, it's kind of like every other Lincoln movie that's ever been made. So, you know, way.
In kind of, you're right. I mean, look.
Yeah, but we're in 2000, but the difference is we're in 2012 now, and we shouldn't be that naive.
Well, what I'm saying is maybe the problem with Lincoln is that it's really about all the Lincoln movies that have ever been made, and it's not necessarily about Lincoln
itself. Guys, actually, do you think it's maybe not? I've said this before on the show. I've said this before many times. Maybe it's not really about Lincoln. It's the fact that maybe it's really. I mean, Kushner really was framing it in terms of today. It's really about. In many ways, you could say this is a film about Obama if you didn't know any of that.
It is. We've talked about that.
Yeah,
I think there is something to that. It's really about you know, reaching across the aisle to mm-hmm. to make peace with your enemies and so forth, or your political enemies or opponents or whatever, and how important that is to get things done, things that are important for the country.
And I think by doing that, while that's a noble gesture, don't get me wrong, by doing that, though, you also dilute the historical potency of the original story.
Uh-huh.
I think that, you know, there was no need to do any of this, but I do think Kushner was much more interested in making a statement about today than he was about the past.
Kushner even said that when you do a Lincoln movie, you have to pick which Lincoln you want to portray. So I'm sure to a certain extent he's willing to accept that, you know, his isn't perhaps the most honest portrayal of Lincoln. It's just the portrayal that he chose to go with.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they go to the author of Team of Rivals. They have long conversations with her, and they say, how do you balance the fact that he passed this amendment, he abolished slavery, and yet he was a white supremacist. And it's a difficult thing to balance. And my point is, the movie is, first of all, I think, inherently dishonest for not even broaching that subject.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it would have been a much richer movie for examining that.
Right.
Yeah. They wanted it to fit a certain, you know, a certain mold, and
you're right.
They were afraid to bring
it. Yeah, because it can't give you the warm Spielbergian fuzzies if it implies that he thought that the whites were far superior to blacks.
Right. No, of course.
So in that way, this is a prime example of what a lot of people complain about Spielberg, which is the over-sentimentalized, you know, glossy version.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, the supreme irony here is that he's probably going to end up winning Best Director, because I really don't
you
see
really,
it going
you think
to anybody else.
You think he could beat, that's an interesting...
Well, it's only between him and Russell, so... And I'm starting to believe that they're going to give Russell screenplay and then give Annika the other screenplay award, and then they'll give Spielberg the director award.
The most interesting category of the night has actually shaped up to be director, with no Ben Affleck in there. That's an interesting category.
Well, it's either the greatest snub. I don't know if Bigelow is now the greatest snub. I think it seems that everyone, though, is up in arms still about Paul Thomas Anderson. I mean, that's the one that people really can't get over.
Well, I think people are now starting to go back to the master and taking a look at it and go, dang, it was really good.
I think that's going to be one of these things, more so than Tarantino or Bigelow or Fleck. I think they're going to be, you know... Anderson, we all thought, back in August and September, Anderson's a shoo-in in this category.
Yeah.
So, we'll see.
So I also watched the documentary. Jerry, did you see this? That Everything or Nothing documentary about the Bond series?
No, no. When was that on? When was that?
It's available on Netflix streaming. It's actually
okay,
really great.
Okay, all right. Yeah, I do have that somewhere probably, and I haven't watched it. No, but I want to see it, yeah.
Yeah, it's really good. It goes through the history of Ian Fleming and the fight to kind of who's going to get the film rights, and making the films, and casting every single Bond. And it's I didn't know a lot about it, so I didn't know the fights between Cubby and Harry Salzberg.
Harry Salzberg, yeah. You know, there are a lot of, I mean, oh, my God, that's like...
Or the Harry Salzman and Sean Connery and how they were fighting and how he quit essentially because he hated Harry. And when Harry was on his deathbed, Sean Connery called him and, you know, essentially said, "I love you." And, you know, they made up on his deathbed. And it was kind of it's a really good overview of the entire 50-year series.
Mm-hmm. Cool. No, all right. Yeah, no, I know. I haven't gotten a chance. I was so consumed with House of Cards a couple of weeks ago, so I haven't watched anything else on Netflix.
Harrison Ford's coming back as Han Solo. That's been confirmed.
Yeah, that's big news. But, you know, I was expecting that, of course.
Yeah, I mean, we figured that, I mean, that, and while I was talking to someone about it, and, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, it's cool, they're making this Star Wars film. I will be surprised if it's really good. That will be the surprise kicker. It's not so much they're making it. If it's any good, it will be the...
Well, I guess... From Harrison Ford's point of view, he's probably thinking, why not? Might be fun, a tribute to the fans, and, you know.
And after all, I've already done Hollywood Homicide, so how bad could it get?
I mean, you have to look at it through that prism. I mean, you've done Hollywood Homicide. You've made a lot of really bad movies, Harrison. This could be...
Yeah, and it'll mean a lot to the fans, I'm sure. You know, it'll be nice. He's always said that role was extremely limited, but it made him.
It did. I mean, he can't not. I mean, I think it's very interesting. I never thought he'd really acknowledge that, but I guess especially after the last Indiana Jones movie, he's maybe, oh, wow, this may be the one.
And plus it gives him a chance to go back, and if he thought the role was limited, he can go back and deepen it now because the character's older. So why wouldn't you try and do that, you know?
Yeah.
That'd be a challenge.
Well, let's hope they do. Let's hope that he is allowed to do that. And let's hope. I think J.J. Abrams will be open to that, and I think the screenwriter will be open to that. Let's hope, though, the puppet master there is open to that at this point. Okay, because he's still
calling
the shots.
Yeah, let's also hope there's no "I'm too old for this shit" jokes.
I know that I'm afraid will be in there, but let's hope that, you know. I mean, Lucas is going to have a bigger hand in this than he's let on, but, I mean, let's hope that maybe he'll just be like, all right, maybe someone will talk to him and say, look, you know, you had your shot with the prequels, and they're damn ruined the whole goddamn series. Come on.
I think that J.J. Abrams is one of those fan directors that really has an eye on pleasing the fans. So I'm curious if when Harrison Ford, in whatever capacity the film uses him, if when he does come back, if... they're going to address the whole who shot first.
They might, you know. That's gonna.
I never even knew
that was an issue until that came out.
Yeah. David Fincher is going through with 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, minus Brad Pitt. But it looked like the project was dead, but they're going through without Brad Pitt, so.
Is it just me, or do I think this is beneath him?
I do, too. It seems like a weird project for David Fincher.
I mean, he could do... I actually... And even though there's no guarantee that the girl who played with fire is even going to be made, and now there's talk that they want to cut Daniel Craig out completely because he asked for more money.
Especially,
and I don't know how you
Skyfall,
cut that character out. Wait, you know, you just don't make the movie then. Just forget about it because you need him. He's a, you know... integral part of the books in the movie in the original films. I don't know why you'd even think about that, but I would think he should go, at least if Sony will go ahead and finance it, let him do the other ones or something, there's got to be something else he wants to do. I can't believe 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea is. It just seems like, I don't care, I'm sorry, I just don't.
It doesn't seem like his kind of movie.
Yeah,
it's written by Scott Z. Burns, who wrote the Bourne Ultimatum and Side Effects. And it's been rewritten by Andrew Kevin Walker,
okay, then maybe it's a different take on it.
Maybe
yeah.
I'll put a serial killer on the novelist, and it'll be really great.
Oh, my God, that would be awesome. All right, he should do it then. He should definitely do it. Okay, if Andrew Kevin Walker wrote it, I mean, not that
hey, that's... Put Sean Connery in it, called 20,000 League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Under anyway, IFC Films has picked up Paul Schrader's The Canyons, and they will release it in the summer.
On video, so video on demand, too.
The Canyons.
Summer viewing.
The Canyons finally found a home.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, bravo to IFC, because I think that this movie, just out of curiosity, is going to get a lot of people buying it to watch it. You know?
It would do
they
wonders for VOD. I mean,
I think so. I think it's perfect for VOD. And actually, Paul Schrader always thought VOD was the
mm-hmm.
home where it should have.
Yeah.
They might turn it off after 20 minutes, but I think they'll buy it.
They will buy it. I think this film could be the game changer for video on demand more so than anything else. I think this will be a very good and a smart move, because no one's going to go see it in a theater. They'll go see it, but everyone will watch it at home, though.
Mm.
Okay, how about this? The whole thing with Kevin Smith doing his next final movie ever, Clerks 3.
Yeah.
He wants to do it on the... he's thinking about doing it on the web, online. He wants to do it.
Well, good.
On parts of it. You know, he's not sure. He's taking... You know, I like what he's done on the podcast and everything. I think that's very innovative. I think he's done a lot of innovative things. But I just, when he announced Clerks 3, it just sounded like, really? You really want to do, I mean, even, I don't care what format it's on, it just seems like a tired idea. I mean,
it's hard to imagine, it's hard to imagine what would be a step back for Kevin Smith.
Well, I don't know about even that, but it just seems like this is not the thing. After Cop Out, which you know, he's just a director for hire on that, but it just seems like Clerks 3, after the second one, it just sounded like, okay, that was a good place to end it, move on. You know, you keep saying you're not going to revisit these characters, yet you keep coming back and revisiting them, so I don't know.
Well, Babs would be a step forward from Cop Out. I'm going to remake Babs.
I'm going to do that.
Kevin Smith's Babs. Yeah. I did see something on demand. I saw this Jeffrey Dahmer Files movie.
Oh, yeah, I was reading about that. How was that?
You know, I read about this because it was, I forget what festival it was accepted at. I think it might have been South by Southwest, and I was earlier in the last year, and I was going through sending out possible interview requests, and I said, well, this is interesting. I'll send a request to this director, but I never actually did. So, but I had it in my head that this movie was out there and it existed, and I was surprised that it was available on demand finally, so I ordered it out of curiosity. It's weird. It's interviews with the arresting officer, or the detective that actually questioned Jeffrey Dahmer,
mm-hmm.
pretty much the main conduit to Jeffrey Dahmer after he was arrested, one of Jeffrey Dahmer's neighbors, and then a forensics guy that examined body parts and stuff in this apartment. And intercut with those interviews aren't necessarily reenactments, because they're not reenactments of anything, any major events in Jeffrey Dahmer's story. They're like an actor playing Jeffrey Dahmer walking into a pet store and buying goldfish, Jeffrey Dahmer renting a hotel room, Jeffrey Dahmer stealing a mannequin. And they, you know, they're kind of arbitrary scenes that they recreate here and there.
Mm-hmm.
The movie has a very artsy, pretentious feel to it. And I think it was done like that because, like I wrote a couple of days ago about it, there's nothing there. I mean, it's not at all in any way interesting or illuminating or doesn't offer any. But the thing about it is, it also doesn't really offer any kind of ghoulish kicks either. It's not sensationalist, which is odd. So it honestly has nothing to offer. Has nothing to offer anyone that is interested in this, that would possibly be interested in the psychology of this thing, or that just wants to watch like a real life Saw. It doesn't satisfy either of those audiences.
Hey, here to pick up my barrel.
Oh,
All right. Yeah, you have your car here?
No.
Wisconsin this morning are investigating a grisly discovery in a Milwaukee apartment.
Dahmer was safe.
Lots of dismembered body parts.
As soon as you walked in there, you could smell that funky, putrid smell of death. In the refrigerator was a severed human head with the eyes and the mouth open like this.
He didn't have too many friends in the building. But he was kind-hearted to people. You know, he would share what he had. If someone asked you to write a horror story, this would be some of the stuff that you would write.
The best way I can describe it is that we were dismantling someone's museum. In a closet, there were some human hands and male genitalia. We had 7 skulls, 5 skeletons. There was so much evidence that it was hard to understand and put everything into perspective.
You have people like me who is befriending you. I've eaten a sandwich from you. I have probably eaten someone's body part.
I have to start eating at home more.
I felt bad for him, and I felt bad that I felt bad for him, right? Like, why do I have empathy for this guy? And he said to me, when I tell you what I'm going to tell you, you'll be famous.
If you don't feed them often enough, they will eat each other.
I've never seen, I've seen a couple of those serial killer movies that were dead as part of that whole series.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah,
I don't know.
This one isn't that. And even something like the Dahmer movie from years ago when Jeremy Renner played Dahmer, at least Jeremy Renner was noticeable in it. Because, actually, Renner walked away from that movie with critical acclaim.
Right,
I mean, he
right.
got on the map for that movie. At least there was that.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that guy? Yeah, I think we played the clip in the best of. The best childhood friend of John Wayne Gacy.
Oh, yeah, that was unforgettable.
Oh, my God. And he talked about going to Gacy's house, like right before he was arrested, and Gacy tried to kill him. Oh my gosh! Yeah.
But see, that might be a very interesting movie.
Yeah, there's nothing that interesting in this Dahmer movie. So.
Yeah.
All right, it's time to read some comments from our
listener mail
on YouTube. That's right. Here's our special listener mail music. On our clip about the top movie trends of the 2000s, this was something from our archives, Twin Joshi says, I have a couple of trends in mind, zombies for one, the independent romance film, raunchy comedies, which was actually one of my top trends on the clip, and found footage films. I think found footage films is definitely a trend.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
That I didn't list to mark the end of the last decade. Marksturbation says, never thought I'd say that on the show. He says, I would have said the trend of remakes would be in my top 10. Remakes. Our Jennifer Lawrence interview.
Oh, that's gotten a lot of them.
Thanks for uploading. I agree, this is a terrific interview. I hope she does more like this. Thoughts on Hitchcock and the girls. Somebody commented and said they loved the girl, and we don't appreciate it because we're men.
Oh, that was from a while back. Yeah, I remember
yeah,
reading that. Okay.
Yeah. Comment on our poll.
I don't get that. Why would anybody say that? I mean, not about that movie. I don't get that. Okay.
Comment on our Paul Schrader interview. Gender Pranks says, put Mishima on Blu-ray, goddammit. That's the end of that comment.
Okay.
Leah
well,
Belzum.
I mean, that's on Criterion, right?
So, yeah, I have the Criterion DVD of that. I mean,
they'll get around
Leah Belzum, Leah Belzum, actress from The Shining, a comment that says, dude, that's awesome. She seems like a very pleasant interviewee who was happy to explain her experience in such an iconic film. Our In Memoriam William Finley or tribute show. I don't know how I missed hearing about Finley's death. I went to see Phantom of the Paradise back when it first came out because I was and still am a Paul Williams fan. There you go. But Finley's Winslow was so perfect. De Palma made a wise choice there. Rest in peace, William. Movies that should be remade. Here's the big list. Hang on, I gotta go to this page to see this. One of our listeners, Pac-Man, listed, it was a big topic of discussion for us, one show, movies that need to be remade. Here are his suggestions. The Alamo, Enter the Dragon, Angels with Dirty Faces, The Birth of a Nation, Top Gun, Legend, Darkman. No, wait a minute. Yeah, those are his. Certain Fury, Mortal Kombat, The Phantom, The Shadow, King of New York, Pacific Heights, Blue Steel, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, Pet Sematary, Backdraft, Escape from New York, and War Games. Okay. Another person chimed in Four Honors and said Super Mario Brothers, Tales from the Crypt, Aliens vs. Predator, Dungeons and Dragons, and Resident Evil.
All I'd rather just blow my brains out. Really, Dungeons and Dragons wouldn't have been good. Come on, really? Okay, yeah. All right, I'd just rather blow my brain out.
Robert Richardson interview, a great interview, Jamie. Such a joy to listen to all he's got to say. Hey, our Robert Richardson video has actually gotten a lot of responses too, and people arguing back and forth once again about his relevancy as a cinematographer. Some people say his work in Kill Bill are my favorites. He's one of the bravest. Another person said, you know, he's irrelevant and he hasn't been interesting since he worked with Oliver Stone. The other person fought back and said, well, he just won an Oscar for Best Cinematographer, so he's still relevant. You could say that you don't like his work as much, but
yeah, I mean,
he's still relevant.
Yeah.
Anyway, goes on and on and on.
That started
greatest,
back and forth?
yeah. Greatest films of the 80s, 360 Sean says, Salvador, James Woods was robbed of an Oscar. The freaking Academy gave it to Paul Newman for sentimentality reasons.
Okay.
Well, yeah, he was great in that movie. Yeah.
No, I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, Salvador is one of Oliver Stone's best films, but, I mean, yeah.
And definitely one of the best movies of the 80s, for sure.
A lot of people like Michael Paré. Leonard Campbell comments on our Purple Rain video. He laughs and he says, I recall Streets of Fire, but only because you mentioned it. I guess I mentioned Streets of Fire in the interview. Exploring the films of Brian De Palma, S. Torres says, great De Palma discussion. I loved Femme Fatale. I thought it was quite underrated. And the MGU predicts best cinematography for 2012, where we tried to predict the winner of the Oscar. This person, Metrom129, says, Kaminsky in the bag. He thinks that Lincoln is a definite for the winner of that award.
I think it's Deakins now. I think it's Deakins is like the...
Who won the Guild Award? Was it Deakins that won?
Was it?
Yeah.
I don't know. It was? Okay, then I think it's a sure thing then that he's going to...
Well, that would be very refreshing and amazing if that happens. I had sort of like written that off as being even a possibility or whatever, but he deserves it just for the Shanghai part alone, you know, or whatever.
Right. In the interview, I agree. It's stunning. In the interview that we did with the digital effects supervisor of Eyes Wide Shut, the only interview of its kind out there, some people have been going back and forth about how Kubrick was killed by the Illuminati. It was no heart attack. That's the discussion going on. Seriously, if you guys want some entertainment, go on our YouTube page, look at some of these videos. We've got 550 or so up, and some of these threads that are on these videos are really, really good. But that thread about Stanley Kubrick actually being killed is the Eyes Wide Shut digital effects supervisor. Christopher Young interview, great interview. I've had the honor of meeting Mr. Young in person, and he is grateful and humble and a truly wonderful person to be in the presence of. In memoriam, Tony Scott. Don't mean to complain, but no mention of the great last Boy Scout, Bruce Willis.
We mentioned that. We talked about that. Come on.
Yeah, I think we did. Yeah, we definitely did.
You listened to the whole thing.
Bruce Willis was sick in that film.
Yes, he was in that film, yes.
D-A-T film. Dirty Harry, our celebration of the Dirty Harry series. That was from years back. I first saw a bit of Dirty Harry when I was 9. It was at a hotel lounge during a birthday party, and there was a TV on. I intently gazed at the screen when Dirty Harry came on. But this guy said, "You shouldn't be watching this. Leave the room, otherwise I'll tell your mom." I watched the whole prologue opening credit scene up to when Harry goes to see the mayor and thought it looked like a cool film. I watched it fully in the 90s. When I showed my brother the Scorpio torture scene, he laughed. Okay, nice story. I love these personal life stories.
Yeah, so go check out our YouTube page, yes.
Yeah. It's a bad idea to reboot Twin Peaks. Twin Peaks was a moment in time. It would be like when the Sex Pistols reunited. It's a bad idea.
Yeah, I remember reading that. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good analogy.
That is a good analogy.
They're probably right about that.
Yeah. All right. So youtube.com/MovieGeeksUnited. Good stuff.
Yeah. Very fun.
All right. So we're going to come back next week for an Oscar pre-show.
That's right.
All right, cool.
So, Jerry, I expect you to talk about what all the stars are wearing.
Dude, with pleasure. With pleasure.
I want to hear you say, "I can't believe that Jennifer Lawrence went with Givenchy."
Bad thing is, Dean, in another life, I probably met him, so I'm not joking when I say that. But, yeah.
Can you imagine like Hannibal Lecter on the red carpet or something?
Dude, that'd be hysterical.
Who are you wearing takes on a whole different meaning.
Yeah, really.
Gutter Handsome.
Yeah, exactly.
Gutter Handsome. Gutter Handsome will not be within 50,000 miles of the Oscars. That will never happen.
Mr. Anthony Greengrass is using weaponized sarin in Laos.
Look, Nikolai, you're accusing a CIA manager and a team of special forces of committing the worst possible kind of war crimes.
Do you believe me?
What do you need?
Sixty kilometers south of Juarez's abandoned prison named Puerto Cobre.
Greengrass is not going to get his hands dirty on this one. He'll send someone else.
I wanted to harm you, Nikolai.
Move away from me, they'll give you evidence.
Is there more?
What is your mission?
I'm just a desk jockey, I appreciate it.
Desk jockey? I don't understand.
You don't know anything about me. How don't you know anything about me?
And that is what we are going to discover. Together.
Why are we both here, Mr. Robert? I am not your enemy!
That doesn't make you my friend.
We have same problem.
You have pictures of my men committing war crimes.
Who knows you're here?
No one. We are going to survive. You must no longer fear dying.
Your arm, it feels good now. It
felt better before you stuck a knife in it.
You let a Soviet kill us. That's treason! Arthur!
I am one with guns.
we take it from them.
Free us out!
We must believe in them. This kind of men do not go away.
A Lonely Place for Dying is a new thriller that's set in the 70s during the Cold War era. It pits a KGB mole against a CIA agent. It is a low-budget film with a big-budget pedigree and a big-budget look. It's an amazing accomplishment. The film stars James Cromwell and Michael Wincott, and it's co-written and directed by Justin Eugene Evans. The movie is now available on iTunes, and it's breaking records all over the place. It is a huge smash hit on iTunes, and I recommend, if you have iTunes, certainly, to purchase it. It's well worth seeing. Here is Justin to tell us all about his movie. I read where you wanted to make your film, A Lonely Place for Dying, reminiscent of the 70s cinema.
Yeah, something I it's a little quirky thing, I believe, as a filmmaker. I'm not sure everyone else needs to do this, and I don't mind if the audience never noticed. But if a movie is set, in my opinion, during an era where cinema existed, meaning any movie from, say, 1898 to, you know, to present day, then I think the movie should be steeped in that particular era's film culture. And so since I knew this was going to be a 1970s Cold War spy thriller, I went out of my way to study everything I could about 70s cinema. And I happen to be a huge fan of 70s cinema. I think it's, you know, if not the greatest era in cinema, easily in the top two or three. And so, you know, the obvious choices was everything from The Conversation, which had already been a favorite film of mine, and I've probably watched it 15 times, to 3 Days of the Condor, to all of the best James Bond movies from the era, the original Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, the original Jackal, and going through, every single thing that came out, whether it was a television miniseries, which I don't think there's a strong distinction between television and film, and Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid, The Sting, those were huge influences on the movie. Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid was probably the second or third greatest influence on the film, and I've had friends of mine tell me that I accidentally created a Western, and that certainly wasn't my intention, but I think that my love of Westerns, and particularly 70s-era Westerns, somehow seeped into what I was doing when I wrote the script.
So when you sat down to write A Lonely Place for Dying, I mean, did you let your imagination kind of run free, or were you thinking, I have to write within the constraints of what would be a reasonable budget for me?
Well, I definitely had to work within our budget, because we only had $200,000, and as I was writing it, we didn't even know we had that much. We thought we only had $120,000, so this was starting out as a very small budget movie, and digital cinema was still fairly young. I mean, now everybody shoots on red cameras, but we were the sixth or seventh movie to shoot on a red camera. Hmm. And so there was a lot of things that we were scared about. And so one of the things, I always start a movie backwards, and it's because of something I read in Robert Rodriguez's book, A Rebel Without a Crew, which is that if you don't have a lot of money, create a list of everything that you can get your hands on for free and incorporate that into your script. And so we decided to take that philosophy and put it on steroids. And we combed all of New Mexico for free locations. At the time, I was an art director for a video game company in Albuquerque. And so we combed everywhere we could for free locations, and there were dozens that were excellent places to shoot part of a movie, but nothing that I felt I could set an entire movie in, nothing that wouldn't end up feeling small. And then by luck, we stumbled across Old Main, which is this abandoned prison about 10 minutes outside of downtown Santa Fe. And, it's somewhere between 300,000 and 500,000 square feet of space, and it had been abandoned for 10 years. And as I walked through there, I said, I could do a movie here. I could set easily 80% of a motion picture inside here. It's like Die Hard. I do with a whole movie here, and no one will feel it's a small film. And so I ended up writing the movie in the prison. I would actually take my MacBook on weekends and crawl through the tunnels, and I knew that I could execute what I was doing because it was writing the scene in the actual room where I was going to be shooting the scene.
The movie is very, for among other things, it's very notable for maximizing every single dollar of the budget. I mean, this looks like it was made for you know, tenfold what you actually spent on it, and that has to
do with the
ambition. Yeah, the ambition and the sophistication of the storytelling. I mean, was there ever a time when you felt that you weren't able to accomplish what you were setting out to do because of financial restrictions, or was there always a creative solution?
Yeah, there a little bit. I mean, it's you know, I wished that I could have done a bigger B-52 bombing sequence at the beginning of the movie. I think we did more than any other low budget movie in history, and I wanted to start the movie off with a bang. And for me, it wasn't just an excuse to show off my team's visual effects prowess. It was also trying to talk a little bit about the politics of the era, because most people don't know this. The movie opens in Vientiane, Laos, and it's the only nation in the history of the planet that has asked the United States to come and bomb it, and it's the most bombed city in history as well.
Mm.
And I thought that's an interesting way to open a movie. Let's open a movie with the U.S. just bombing the living hell out of a third world country. It's almost like the opposite of the beginning of Star Wars. You know, we're the Empire, and they're the little rebellion. So that was fun, but I couldn't do enough. You know, it's I wanted 15, 20 shots of B-52 bombers, and what we could afford on our budget was 2, and we get a lot of bang for our buck out of those 2 shots. But it would be, if I could be let loose with $5 million. I believe that my team could do something that looks like it cost $100 million.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Hopefully that will happen.
Well, the movie looks phenomenal the way it is. And also, you've assembled such a great A-list cast. I mean, with actors like Cromwell and Michael Wincott. Tell me about approaching them. Excuse me. Tell me about the process of approaching those two actors in particular.
Most people are walking around with the assumption that movie stars are inaccessible and you have to have backdoor connections to get movie stars. That's just not true. If you've got a good script, movie stars are very easy to access. And so, you know, I was living in Albuquerque at the time. I didn't go to L.A., and all we did was submit the script directly to the actors via their agents, you know, and the agents can be looked up on IMDb Pro. So this information is at everybody's fingertips. And by law, an agent must bring a screenplay and an offer to whoever they represent. They're breaking the law otherwise. And you don't even have to remind them of that. You know, we were coming to the table and said, we can pay your client X number of dollars. We think we're going to need them for 2 days. And here's the perk package that we can afford. You know, we're a very small budget movie, so please don't expect the kind of perks in a studio film, but we can still treat them right. And here you go. And because of that, we almost had Liam Neeson. We almost had Tim Robbins. We actually had Michael Ironside. And we were very close to closing that deal and making an official offer when Michael Wincott became interested in the project, and I felt that Michael Wincott fit the role just a little bit better than Michael Ironside would, although he's a phenomenal actor, and I'd kill to work with him in another film. And that's all there is to it.
But you, I mean, tell me about the first day of shooting, because this is your first major feature?
Yeah, before this, all I've done is shorts.
Okay.
And
so
I was ready. I've been ready for a long time.
But I've heard, you know, well, someone had a story that it's important on your first day to set a tone of confidence to to do a shot or do a scene in a take or two, and then move on, because then the crew knows that you're serious and you can and you know your stuff. But tell me about the.
I didn't do that.
Tell me about the anxiety.
I probably average about. I average about 18 takes per shot, and so if there are strategies on how to manage a crew, I probably screwed up on every single one of those strategies. I just start whittling away, and so you know the our schedule was built based on which actors were available to begin with, and what shots were easiest to do, and we started to start outside the prison because it required less lighting. But you know, I'm very meticulous. One of the things that I believe is one of the greatest mistakes of most independent films is their crews are too big, and the bigger your crew, the less things you can shoot. Those two things are inversely proportional to each other. So, I said, no. The whole trick to making a good movie is not an 80-person crew. The trick is more days, because the more time I can spend on a moment, the more it's just me and an actor crafting this one little moment, or me and the camera operator just going over that camera move and getting and pulling the focus as perfectly as possible. That's what makes the movie great. So we had an 18-person crew, but unlike most micro-budget movies, we had 36 days to shoot, and that's a pretty luxurious schedule. So I only had to get through about three pages a day. And so I knew I had about a page and a half before lunch and a page and a half on, after. And so we just worked through it. My crew certainly rebelled. In fact, there was a couple crew members that thought I was insane for the number of takes I would take. And every single time I would say, "Do you know how many takes Fincher takes?" And their response was always, "Well, you're not Fincher." And after a while, you realize you're going through a trial by fire that there's no way around. Your crew does not believe that you are talented, and they don't believe that your decisions are actually based on studying motion pictures for 30 years. And so like as an example, I tend to not like extreme close-ups. I think they're overused, and I think they come from a generation of filmmakers who have watched too much cinema on television. And that if you go back to cinema of the 50s and the 60s and in the early 70s, that the camera happens to usually be further away. And a lot of what I wanted to do with The Lonely Place for Dying was establish how grand the location was. You know, we had six-story sets given to us for free, and I wanted to milk that for all I could. So a lot of my influence was like, you know, David Lean in Sir Lawrence of Arabia, and huge, vast, wide shots where our actors would be these little tiny specks, maybe only 20 pixels tall. And my camera op kept saying, "We got to punch him for a close-up. We got to punch him for a close-up." Like, no, we don't. We don't need a close-up. And it was difficult because he would not trust that I knew where to put the camera. But I think that's just inevitable because, you know, that's exactly what George Lucas went through on the original Star Wars. His crew just treated him like crap. And from what I hear, that's what Steven Spielberg dealt with in the early days that he did television episodes. And all I could think of was, I'm going to stick to my guns. I'm not going to bend. I storyboarded the entire movie. I wrote the script. I know what movie I'm making. Mm-hmm. And the work will speak for itself. There's no doubt I made mistakes. I look back and there's a lot of things I would change, but I could see my own style emerging from the movie. And I thought the next movie is going to be easier because hopefully the film will have done well and people will start to trust that I know what I'm doing when I tell a story. And luckily what we did on the festival circuit, I think speaks towards the craftsmanship of the film. And hopefully that's enough to make the next movie a little less work.